Welcome to Be Reasonable, a podcast from the Merseyside Skeptic Society, hosted by Michael Marshall. In each monthly interview, we'll examine beliefs from outside of the mainstream, exploring how those views are constructed and what evidence people feel they have to support their case. We believe in approaching subjects with respect and an open mind, engaging with people of different viewpoints in an environment where debate is polite and good-natured, yet robust and intellectually rigorous. Joining me this week on Be Reasonable is Michael Davidson from the Core Issues Trust. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I know that Core Issues Trust describes itself as a non-profit Christian ministry supporting men and women with homosexual issues who voluntarily seek change in sexual preference. Practically, what does that work involve?
Well, very often these people don't feel that they have a place to go. They may have tried more traditional routes. They're serious about moving out of homosexual behaviors or feelings, and they might go to psychotherapists or psychologists, and for whatever reason, it hasn't worked out for them. Others, by word of mouth, come in our direction. They may be drawn for various reasons, and then we work with them to see what their goals are and what they want to try to achieve. Can't help everyone, but some people we can, and we work with them.
I see, and I know I've had a look through some of the material core issues have put out. They seem to talk a lot about how human sexuality is fluid for some and therefore changeable in some cases. So is this the view of Core Issues, that human sexuality is a fluid thing? You aren't necessarily straight, you aren't necessarily gay. There is a spectrum in between, and people's sexual identity might move between these things at different points in their life.
Yes, and I suppose in that regard, we would reflect the 2014 statement of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, which ceased at that point to say that homosexuality was genetic, and paid attention to the fact that it does change, although they wouldn't support the idea that it is changeable or it can be changed. So we think that that is an important narrative, that there is fluidity. I suppose what we would challenge is these categorical notions of sexuality that want to describe human sexuality as innate and immutable. We'd have an issue with all of that.
I think a lot of people would agree, I suppose, that human sexuality is neither innate nor immutable. I think that would be the prevailing view of a lot of people, and it's why labels, I suppose, like straight, gay, aren't helpful when the reality of human experience is that there is a vast spectrum in between, and people rarely fall one end or the other, and kind of nor should they, I suppose.
Well, I think for a long time there was a political agenda that took advantage of the commonly held view that once you, you're born gay, and once gay, always gay. And so the socio-political construct, I suppose, of this idea of gay is something that we wanted to challenge. And so the current narrative, and I would say research on sexual fluidity, is something that is helpful in the work that we do.
It's interesting when we talk about sexual fluidity, I think most people would see that as being there is the freedom throughout one's life to express oneself as you feel is relevant at that phase of your life or in that moment. So you may be straight sometimes or relatively straight sometimes, moving towards more homosexual experiences at other times. A lot of people talk about fluidity as a two-way street, but it seems like a lot of what Core Issues are saying is that because sexuality is fluid, people can go one way down that street from gay to straight. Would I be right in thinking you don't counsel people to say, well, don't see yourself as straight because your sexuality is fluid? We should be looking to see ourselves as a much more fluid experience, and maybe you shouldn't be locked off from ideas of homosexuality.
Well, for me, what is helpful is really the experience of the ancients, as it's revealed pretty well in the secular history, for example, from the Greco-Roman world, where I think people were in many ways inclined in that direction. They would experience sexual encounters with different genders. I would say that they were much more of a pansexual society, and I think they would have some understanding of what fluidity is all about. I think because we are dealing with a small population of people who want out of homosexual behaviors, I can understand why you're saying that maybe we have a limiting view of fluidity. But I think we're focusing on the needs of these people who have been told very often that they can't change and that they would be inauthentic to try to do so. So I guess I can agree with you that there is something of a kind of limited view of what we're saying about fluidity there. But a lot of my work would be about challenging these labels and interrogating what we mean by gay or straight. The work that we do is not about pushing people to become straight. We do come from an Orthodox Christian point of view, and I think that accords with people who have conservative values, and so there's a fit there. But there are also people who come in our direction who don't have a faith point of view, who have a no faith point of view, who just want to deal with the behaviors and the feelings. And therefore, this idea of fluidity is important and is supportive of the hope that they have of moving away from these things.
Mm. See, I think that's quite interesting, even as you express that you're effectively, you know, saying we come from a faith background, but we don't mind whether you are a believer or whether you're secular, so long as you want to move towards being straight rather than gay.
Well, you see, we wouldn't use what you've just said there, as long as you want to move towards straight. What we are saying is, what we are doing is looking at the needs that people have, the expressed needs, the autonomous desire that these individuals have to go in a different direction. I think that's slightly different. Now, not all of them want to end up in a relationship with a person from the opposite sex, or in a, you know, traditional marriage family. Some of them just want to deal with the behaviors, and that's what they do, and they're more open-ended. So needs are different, and goals and agendas are different.
Mm. I think I'm probably right in thinking that a lot of mainstream psychology, psychiatry, you know, counselling would rather than necessarily say to people, these are behaviours that you may feel you want to move away from for whatever reasons, rather than saying, here's how you can move away from those. They would look to say more, well, let's examine why you want to move away from those behaviors, and what is it that that drives you to want to change that? Is it shame? Is it social embarrassment from the position you happen to be in, where you don't feel that those behaviors are acceptable in that that social circle, social space that you're moving within, and try to examine first the motivations for moving before before thinking about the mechanisms of behavioural change. That mainstream psychology would see acceptance as a better, a more healthier psychological position to be in than the desire to change one's desires and behaviours. So how would you speak to that mainstream psychological view from your own perspective?
Well, I would say that that's standard psychotherapeutic and counseling practice, that whoever comes, you do spend time understanding why they've come. Have they been sent? Are they under pressure? Is there some unresolved conflict that is pushing them in this direction that means that they really aren't free in what they are seeking to do? And absolutely, the work that we would do is about self-acceptance, understanding limitations, understanding realistic goals. It's not about some technique or a one trick approach that is applied to each and everybody that comes. It's very much more nuanced, understanding their goals, understanding their histories, where there are traumas, understanding those traumas and seeing what the impacts of that may have been, and working with them to achieve what they want to. So I realized that there would be those who would question our right to be doing this work, but I would argue that we are not doing anything different. We are we're taking seriously the goals of individuals, and we are wanting to give realistic information. It's not about forcing anybody who comes in one specific direction. Obviously, we have our strengths, and we have a history of how we work and what we do, and that is usually known to the clients who come in our direction. But it's not an open and shut thing. It's not that we can that we can encourage people to go in a direction that we want them to go in. It's all about the relationship between a therapist and counselor and the client.
I think it's interesting you said before that you don't that's not successful for everyone. And as you're talking through there, you say, you know, that you first try to understand the underlying motivations. Roughly what percentage of people do you think you turn away as not being suitable for going through the counselling that you offer?
Well, I don't know in hard numbers, but there certainly are cases where people are, I would say, there because they haven't spent enough time understanding their circumstances or the pressures that are upon them. And it might be that the fit between whoever's doing the counseling and the person who's presenting themselves for counseling, you know, is not a viable one. And so it's just not going to work. And there are, you know, in the last year, there have been one or two, maybe two, where that has applied.
Okay, and just for context, how many people would you say that you that Core Issues Trust treat or deal with or counsel over the course of the year?
Well, in a busy week, up to 21. At the moment, because I'm busy with so many other things, I'm certainly seeing, I don't know, probably four or five a week. Most of that is in a Skype context or on the phone. These are usually long-term clients who have been for many months on this journey. It's not a huge number, but we think it serves a population group who have a specific need.
Because one of the reasons I ask, I suppose, is just to gauge a size, you know, gauge a feeling of the size of the organisation. Because it's fair to say that in terms of prominence or in terms of awareness, you may well punch above your weight for the size of organisation you are. I mean, obviously, you've been the subject of several large, you know, court cases and things like that, including the advertising that you had on the you wanted to put up on the London buses. So, given the size of your organisation, the campaign of advertising on the buses, what was the goal of that campaign? If you are a relatively small organisation who may not have the resources to deal with a huge influx of new clients,
to raise awareness, to have a critical position in what is otherwise a pretty bland narrative in society these days. You're right, the organization is small. The funding that we raise is very project-based. And when there are meetings or conferences or events that are taking place, that's when supporters and volunteers come together. So that's how it works, and that's where the emphasis is.
Because I was just in researching the show, you know, looking through the ad and looking through some of the language, I guess, that that associates or is associated with some of the claims or some of the statements made by core issues or in this kind of area. You know, the advert being, you know, I believe it was ex-gay, proud, get over it. Elsewhere on the on your site, you talk about how individuals are, you believe they're not victims of their sexual desires. Is it fair to say that some of the language you use is provocative?
Well, I'm sure it's perceived in that way. I think the London bus case, not gay, ex-gay, post-gay and proud, was, you know, a bit of a mouthful. I think what we should have said in retrospect is, some people were gay. Some people were gay. Get over it. We were trying to, I guess, parody and reflect off the Stonewall statement and trying to present an opposite and, in our view, valid point of view. So I'm not sure we always get it right in terms of the language, but I don't believe that we're trying to be provocative for the sake of being provocative. I think we will challenge and we will take issue with some of the received language. And I know we have received language, but I think part of the importance of having different points of view is making sure we can articulate a different point of view and argue for that position. So I think that's what we try to do, and that's what we try to reflect. I'm sure we don't always get it right.
When you say you take issue with some of the received language, could you expand on that a little?
Well, take the notion of orientation, take the notion of gay, take the notion of straight, this binary model that the world is made up of gays and straights with a few bisexual people. I think that that is language that needs to be interrogated. I'm not sure that orientation, this idea of categories, male, female, and gay, almost you could put it in those terms, is a valid way of looking at human sexuality in this world that we live in now, where we see it as being much more fluid. And my reference to the ancient world, I think, applies again. This is actually not new teaching. This is actually a very ancient phenomena that we are seeing. And the drive towards pansexuality in the world today, I think, comes from very ancient roots. So taking the term orientation, whereas I think most people see that as fixed and innate and immutable, we would say that it's quite possible that human sexuality is about patterning, that neurologically responses are encountered, reinforced, they become habitual, in some cases they become addictions, but neural pathways are laid down early in life. And when these are fed and watered, so to speak, they become the dominant way in which we operate. Now, I think that's a different way of understanding the term orientation. So we think it's important that we critique that terminology, and because we come from a Christian point of view also, we look at it from a biblical point of view and interrogate the fact that terms like orientation seem to be being received uncritically within the faith community. Is that really what we want to do?
I think that's quite interesting. There's a number of things in there that I could dig into. So permit me to just sort of run through relatively quickly if I can, and then we can maybe sort of explore them a little further. I do think you're absolutely right that the idea of that the binary classification of people into male or female or into straight or gay is not something that is particularly helpful for society. And I think, you know, an awful lot of bisexual people would 100% agree with you there. And the erasure of bisexual people from these conversations is often something that is an overlooked harm here. But I think it is interesting that you talk about there being split into genders of male, female, and gay, as if gay is part of the gender conversation rather than the sexuality conversation, rather that it's a almost a biological issue, which you've denied, than a description of impulse, behaviour, attraction, as most people would say. So, you know, men can be gay, women can be gay. Gay isn't in the man-woman conversation, it's in the which genders of people are you attracted to.
And yet, as a category, it's by many people, I would still say, well, it's hard to quantify, but commonly people think that you're born gay and that it doesn't change. That's what I mean about a categorical notion of sexuality. Mm. And I think more than a view of somebody being on some kind of spectrum, it's fixed. You can't do anything about it. I hear that over and over again. And in discussions that certainly I'm involved in, the only way of resolving it is to say, well, a person who does move away from it must therefore be bisexual. So it's a set of language and terms that I think just aren't helpful for people who have a desire to move away from feelings. So
yeah, so I think what's interesting there is that part of that, I think the solution, there's a lot of people who would identify all across the spectrum and would normally identify themselves and would actually identify themselves as being quite liberal when it comes to human behavior, human sexuality. They would agree that the rigid adherence to category is not helpful to anyone, when actually the reality of human behavior falls between the cracks of those categories, and behavior is fluid. Someone who could have had exclusively male partners their entire life could still be attracted to women but not have had any experiences with women. Yeah. Because they just haven't found women who they were interpersonally attracted to in their real life. That doesn't mean that they aren't categorically attracted to women. It just means they haven't had attractions or experiences with women in reality. And I think so people would argue that throwing out the labeling is far more helpful than saying, no, what we need is to be able to counsel you away from one label towards another label, take you out of one box and put you into another box rather than remove the box entirely. And it kind of comes back, I suppose, to a point you were making, that these behaviors echo behaviors of the ancients, you know, the Greco-Romans, which, when you made the point the first time, I assumed you were saying that there isn't anything new under the sun. It's not that we are the first time as a society dealing with the fact that human sexuality isn't black or white, but is many shades of grey. And this is something that has actually been innate throughout human civilization, because it's innate throughout humanity. It is an innate part of our sexuality. And that I would then suggest that, because we've seen this all the way through human history, this isn't something that is that the times throughout human history where we have been forced into rigid gay or straight or, well, straight or aberrant other to be attacked and marginalized, as has happened at regular points throughout history. Those have been the times when we are moving away from the reality of the human sexual condition.
Well, I think that would be the argument that is being made, as we revert to principles and cultures that were common in the Greco-Roman world. I think that's exactly what is happening. From a Christian point of view, we are returning to pre-Christian values in society, and that's what I guess, is the subject of the culture wars and the discussions that we have. I don't think there's any question that human experience embraces a wide range of sexual possibilities, and that humans fondly explore all of those. The work I am dealing with is around a set of values that are very important to some people, not everybody, but some people want to move towards heterosexual experience. I hesitate to use that term, but that is what they want. And we think that their desire needs to be taken seriously, and they need to be given support and not simply left in the cold or encouraged to think about, you know, why they want that, and are they the subject of some internalized homophobia. It's just too simplistic for these people, and it discredits their desire to go in a new direction.
I think it's interesting that you talk about values there, because I think that's possibly the part of the conversation we've not been having, as we talk in a more sort of cold categorical terms about behavior and the actual actions people take. Because I think a values is an important part of this conversation. You know, you say that people might want to move away from certain actions, and people have we're moving away from Christian values and moving back towards pre-Christian values. That feels to many people, I'm assuming, like that comes with a moralistic judgment that, for example, Christian values are better than pre-Christian values, and because Christian values involve do not involve homosexual behaviors, therefore homosexual behaviors are morally not compatible and morally objectionable to Christian values. Would that be a fair summation of the Christian perspective on it?
Well, I think certainly, yes, Orthodox Christianity or conservative Christianity would make the point that homosexuality is not the healthiest option for people to engage in. And there's an obvious misfit with a broader point of view that wants to argue that it's totally normal and should be embraced as such. You know, there is a conflict there.
When you say the healthiest option, do you mean physically, psychologically, emotionally? What do you mean by healthiest in that context?
All of the above.
And why do you think that it's not the healthiest option?
Because I don't think that is how we were designed to be. Obviously, this accords with a set of ideas and principles that are important to us as people who value the Christian gospel. I understand that, you know, for many people that in itself is received language that is not necessarily language that is open to critique. Hmm. In the end, what we are concerned to do is give people who feel that they want to accord or they want to how can I say this? They see a consistency between their bodies and how their bodies function and their behaviors that they feel are aberrant and are inconsistent with that design. We want to take that seriously and explore that with them and see where it goes.
Hmm. See, I can understand that, but it seems, even as you've expressed there, to explain why homosexuality, in your opinion, is physically unhealthy, you have to go back to the first principle of how we were designed, by which I assume you mean God designed man and woman, and according to the Bible, nothing more than that in terms of gender or sexuality. So it seems like to define health, you have to go back to a first principle that is not compatible with modern day's understanding of health.
Well, that probably reflects my narrow training and background, but I could introduce you to medics who would argue from a medical point of view, or psychologists who would argue from, you know, from that point of view. So I don't think that I'm necessarily doing a great job of explaining, you know, in great detail why these are unhealthy behaviors. But my reading of the medical science and the psychological literature, certainly among those who have always represented within psychology the point of view that I'm coming from, indicates that it isn't the healthiest option. Hmm. It may be a choice, and it may be a, and I'm not saying that, you know, people choose these, this so-called orientation, but people who go in that direction, you know, from that, those points of view, don't necessarily have the best opportunity in terms of life expectancy or mental health opportunities.
Yeah, so what I think is kind of important there, there's two elements, I suppose, to it. One is you're saying this is your best explanation of the reading that you've done, and other people could explain it with details that you aren't able to furnish with, which is totally understandable. You know, we can't be across everything, but you are someone, as you said yourself, that will see clients. So one would imagine this stuff would come up with clients if you're to say to people that homosexuality is physically unhealthy, emotionally unhealthy, you know, moralistically unhealthy. You'd imagine that to say that and be seeing clients regularly, you'd have the grounding in that to be able to explain that to people. So it seems like there's a bit of an incompatibility there.
I'm not sure that's true, because what I would do if those questions came up, we would research it. We'd probably research it together. We would look at a range of papers. I would certainly refer them to people who had an expertise that I don't have. I would certainly encourage them to speak to their GP around certain issues. So I don't think that what I do with clients falls short of helping them to achieve the best understanding that they need to achieve to be able to make informed decisions.
Mm. Well, I guess the other side of it that I wanted to look at, even of that, you know, homosexuality is unhealthy. You mentioned life expectancy. You mentioned other sort of metrics by which we measure health. But how much of that is influenced by long-term ingrained homophobia? You know, it hasn't even been that long since homosexuality was decriminalized, let alone accepted in society. So it's easy to see how a marginalized community could end up in a position where they are far more likely to suffer from depression and anxiety if society has for centuries told them they are the unwanted, they are aberrant in their behavior, and that they are unacceptable and ought to change. And if that's the case, when it comes to bus adverts that tell people that people are ex-gay, get over it, when it comes to talking about the victims of their sexuality, that language doesn't help in diffusing what is a society that still has plenty of the trappings, either implicit or explicit, of homophobia.
I think what we need to do is make sure that there is no viewpoint discrimination. And if there's a difference in viewpoint, we need to bring the viewpoints to the table, and we need to have it out. We need to have the conversations. But when we argue that therapeutic support from the point of view that I'm coming from is banned, needs to be banned, I think that we're kind of vacating that opportunity to debate and understand carefully what the issues are. It's only, 40, 50 years ago that the Royal College of Psychiatrists and the General Medical Council were doing frontal lobotomies and doing chemotherapy and using electroshock techniques to bring an end to what they thought was homosexual behavior that was wrong in every sense of the word. Now they're at eight.
But part of that wrong was they thought that homosexual behavior was mentally and physically unhealthy.
Well, exactly. So the point is, they did that. now they are at a total opposite end, wanting to ban any work that is done to offer people support who want to go in a different direction. And I think that has come about because we have not allowed rigorous debate from different ideological points of view. The science needs to transcend the ideologies that inevitably all practitioners bring with them. But we don't discover it and we don't tease it out unless there is this critical interface between different points of view. And I think that's the problem now.
Well, I mean, I do absolutely agree that the science has to be independent of the ideology, which is, I guess, why I was asking earlier why you believe that homosexuality is the least healthy, is an unhealthy option. And you brought me to, we weren't designed that way. The Bible didn't say that way.
Yes, but then I said there are other arguments. I have, I have positioned myself in relation to that history, if you like. But there are other arguments about the design of our body, that our genitals work in a certain way. And when we go beyond that, there are consequences in our bodies. I think it's clear.
So how do you mean by consequences? Sorry.
There are illnesses. There are physical issues with certain types of sexual activity, sometimes associated with gay living and life, that I think are harmful.
Well, I think it's hard to tease out exactly quite what you mean by that without going into too much detail, which I feel we're reluctant to do. But if that's the case, is it not better to advise on safe sexual practice? I mean, one of the things that we've had, since the 1960s, when it comes to heterosexual relationships, is things like birth control, the ability for people to express their entirely natural sexual desires while minimizing the risk of transmission of sexually transmitted infections, that kind of stuff. It's been proven in the heterosexual arena for a long time that abstinence-only policy only leads you to a population that is routinely practicing unsafe practices. It would seem that if there are practices in homosexual relationships, and we must only really be talking about men here because there's not really an awful lot that women may be doing that isn't routine in a male-female relationship too. We're far better from a public health standpoint and from a public mental health standpoint, advising people on how to practice things safely and ensure the safety of themselves throughout activities, rather than saying, well, the reason that we need to move away from these things is because they are naturally unhealthy.
I think what we're forgetting here is the possibility that there are psychological and historical issues that very often impact on individuals' lives that mean that they act in a way now that is a result of those histories. And the work of counseling and psychotherapy is about understanding those connections between a person's history and a person's behavior. So there may be a whole emotional connection between what they are doing and what they are experiencing. And in the case of those who come in our direction, the unhappiness that they experience and what's gone on in their early lives. So it has to be far more than giving advice about safe practice. It has to be looking at the whole person and the well-being of individuals.
Mm. See, I would absolutely agree that the well-being of the individuals is incredibly important. But it is also fair to say that there are plenty of people who have grown up with homosexual feelings in either cultures, societies, families, geographical areas, where those feelings would not be socially acceptable, and that's led to a huge amount of mental anguish. And looking at the extreme end of that, the suicide rates for people who do identify as LGBT are higher than the population who don't.
Well, I'm not sure that's quite accurate. If you, for example, if you look, I think there's an article in the Royal College Journal, I think it's 2004, by Robin Matthey. She distinguishes between suicidal completion and suicidal ideation. And if you're talking about suicidal ideation, then what you've just said is correct. But it's incorrect if you talk about suicidal completion, which is not correct. It's not higher among the gay community. So that's a good example of where we need to be looking closely at the science and listening to both points of view. My fear is in the climate that we have in the UK, we can no longer do that. We can't have this argument. The program that you are offering today is actually quite rare. I mean, I know there are Ofcom moments where a different point of view is presented on mainstream media. But actually, if you listen to gay activists, many of them seem to want society to say, we've had the debate, there's no discussion. It's a very unscientific point of view, I think, to say that we never again look at the evidence. We never again have the conversation. And we no longer reformulate the research question because it's done and dusted. That's the problem.
I would agree that in a purely intellectual sense, science should never ever see anything as off the table. Although there are certainly issues, there are certainly subjects for which that you can reach a point where rehashing the debate is not always done with the intent of trying to get closer to the truth, but more with the intent to try and leave open a possibility that allows people to, not you, but in other cases, disguise their bigotry. For example, we wouldn't now be debating whether people of Afro-Caribbean descent are of lesser value than people of Caucasian or European descent, even though that was something that was, you know, would have been widely held a century or two ago, and in some parts of the world, a week or two ago, or even less. Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons that we don't keep everything on the table and debate the value of individuals or the values of individual lifestyles is because there are some people who are bad actors in that conversation who want to keep that conversation open in order to launder their bigotry into public opinion.
But the issue is who decides. The mutual consent that arrives at that decision that we're not going to go in that direction any longer. Who decides? It has to represent serious contenders on both sides of the fence. And I don't believe that we're doing that in the UK. And I certainly don't believe that the mental health bodies in the UK, the UKCP, for example, who refused me permission to complete my training, ruled that I could continue my work once I changed my ideas. They didn't spend any time at all in terms of written evidence that was submitted to me that critiqued the arguments that I had presented for working in this direction, working with people who had unwanted same-sex attraction and using standard psychotherapeutic and counseling techniques to help those people. So, from my point of view, that's an ideological decision. It's something that we see in all of the mental health bodies pretty well across the Western world, but not completely in all of them in the USA. And I think that is worrying. It's also akin to the decision in 1973 to remove homosexuality from the DSM. And if you look back historically and you look at who agreed with the decision and who disagreed with the decision, you will be aware that the decision was taken prematurely in terms of the debate, in terms of how many people, many qualified psychiatrists at the time felt that, that we should be dealing with that. I think it's problematic. We don't have the means of working through these issues properly, and we suffer the consequences.
So it sounded for a second there that you were saying that the removal of homosexuality from the DSM was taken prematurely and incorrectly. But I just wanted to clarify whether you believe homosexuality should be listed still in the DSM.
I think that individuals should have the right to access professional help for unwanted same-sex attractions. And the only thing that prevents them from doing that is the fact that there's no capacity to do that because it's not listed as an issue that needs to be dealt with. What is now listed, it seems to me, is an idea that if you're unhappy with it, that, you know, that's a problem. We can deal with the people who are unhappy with their homosexuality because that's going towards mental illness, but nothing else is. So, no, I'm not saying homosexuality is a mental illness, but what I am saying is it has consequences for mental illness, for sure, I would say. And we need to have a mechanism that enables people who want out of it to get professional help from people who are prepared to give them unbiased help.
Define unbiased help?
That has an open mind, that values their autonomous choice to leave homosexual behaviors and feelings if they want to do that. But to say that it is impossible to do that, or that it is harmful or potentially harmful to do that, without presenting the peer-reviewed longitudinal research in support of that, I think is folly.
See, I think that's an important point, that you're saying to write something off as having the potential for harm without having long-term longitudinal studies, without having subjected people over a long period of time to the thing that you are saying has the potential for harm to prove there's harm is folly. But surely in any scientific endeavor, in any public health endeavor, in any endeavor that could have an impact on someone's psychological or physical well-being, the first principle is do no harm. So surely before any interventions are introduced, you don't need the long-term longitudinal studies that prove them harmful to remove them. You need the studies that prove them effective and not harmful to introduce them. Otherwise, we're in a position where we can say, well, anybody can go off and do anything, because until in 20 years' time, we have the studies that show what you're doing actually was incredibly harmful. I mean, you could postulate that policy could be taken to say, well, if somebody comes to you with suicidal ideation, you should talk to them about all the ways that they could or should commit suicide. And until 20 years later, when you see the suicide rates go way up from your therapy, that's the only time that you should be banned from doing that. Well, we'd actually take the safety first approach and say, prove it's safe before you do it.
And that's a very convenient way of responding, isn't it? Because we know that you cannot do randomized controlled trials in this area. There's no ethical committee in any university that will allow human subjects to have that kind of research done one way or the other. It wasn't me. It was the American Psychological Association that said that there's no evidence one way or the other. In other words, our research methodologies are not up to proving things as they are usually constructed. We have to look at completely different ways of understanding the phenomena on both sides of the experience divide. And what that's going to mean is an open-mindedness that seeks to gather information but refuses to set public policy based on activism from whichever position. You cannot set public policy based on anecdote, whether it's, you know, whatever it is. That's why I'm arguing for a cross ideology, different viewpoint discussion when the country set about putting together the memorandum of understanding, again led by the UKCP, Pink Therapy, the Royal College of Psychiatrists, and I think, I don't know, 11 other mental health organizations. They refused to allow anybody from a different point of view. I have the correspondence with then Minister, Secretary of State Norman Lamb, who refused to allow us any part of the conversation because he and they, I presume, considered we were too far from what they were wanting to do. I can send you the letter. That's not helpful. Let's have the discussion. Let's find the people who are best placed to present all of the evidence. But to set policies in motion that clearly discriminate against people who have a different set of values and who have different goals is worrying.
But is the purpose of society not to to weigh up sets of values against the effect of those sets of values? You know, that's just a normal part of society. We're actually seeing right now the rise of people with a set of values which runs directly contrary to the well-being of large swathes of society, and we try not to afford those values undue amount of weight. So that, isn't that kind of the purpose of policy, is to weigh values against the communities that those values might have an impact upon?
Well, I think we have to find mechanisms that are much more representative, but because what we don't want is a simple majoritarianism where governments simply go in the direction that, you know, is responsive to the loudest voice. Democracies surely take care of true minorities and listen carefully. It's easy.
And by true minorities, in this kind of analogy, do you mean people who experience homosexual feelings but don't want them? Those are the minorities that we're talking about here.
Well, they would certainly be a minority that I think have been very clearly discriminated against. We hear all about the harm that is done to people who are forced into so-called conversion therapy, but we hear absolutely nothing about those who have been denied access to professional help, or have been simply, as I was told, to simply, you know, get on with being gay, divorce my wife, and go in that direction. It's not a good indication of democratic principles playing out in important policies in our society.
I mean, actually, that brings us to possibly a nice place to sort of take the interview as we head towards the close, is that your background to this isn't in a purely academic or from the administering of a therapy. This is a process or a situation you found yourself in, I understand.
Yes, I was conflicted. I was married and still conflicted. Didn't know how to resolve my issues. Didn't know where I could talk about them. When I did talk about them with some professionals, I was simply encouraged to embrace that reality, which is something that I didn't want to do. I think it's tragic that people today are being denied the opportunity that I was given. I eventually found a psychiatrist and at least two psychotherapists who simply took me seriously. I'm sure they didn't necessarily agree with everything I said or every goal. They certainly challenged me, but they gave me the opportunity to work through the issues that I was distressed about. I valued remaining married and having a consistency with my children that I wanted. And I feel that that is something that needs to be respected, but it isn't, I'm afraid. It simply isn't. And the evidence that I present for that is the people who come in my direction who seemingly have been almost forced to end their marriage and embrace a set of values and behaviors that they simply don't want.
Mm. Well, Mike, I think this is probably a good time to end our conversation here. I've really enjoyed chatting to you. I hope our listeners have enjoyed it too. Thank you so much for being on the show. If people want to find out more about the work that you're doing and some of the issues around that, where should they go?
Core Issues Trust, or if they want to listen to the testimonies and stories of individuals and those who support them, voicesofthesilence.tv.
Brilliant. And thanks so much for giving your time to Be Reasonable. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Be Reasonable is a production of the Merseyside Skeptic Society featuring Michael Marshall. To find out more, visit merseysideskeptics.org.uk/podcasts. You can follow me on Twitter at Mr. M. Marsh, and you can support the show at patreon.com/merseyskeptics. The theme music was by Dan Thomason, and you can find out more about his work at danielthomason.com.